This is Teresa Caraggio with Third Paradigm, broadcasting for Free Radio Santa Cruz and Upstart Radio Online. Today, thanks to the good people at Capitola Book Cafe, I have the opportunity to interview Daniel Pinchbeck. Daniel is the author of Breaking Open the Head, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, and most recently, Towards 2012, Perspectives on the Next Age. 2012 is the end of the Mayan calendar and the imminent transition from one world to another prophesied by the Hopi Indians of Arizona. I read the book when it came out 3 years ago and underlined and annotated my copy, sometimes with stars and exclamation points, sometimes with marginal arguments, but leaving few pages in their original virginal state, although I'm sure that's a word few would apply to Daniel's text. When I recorded an announcement for Daniel's reading tonight, I read one of those passages I'd marked with multiple asterisks. It was a 10-line sentence that described the alien music of the name Quetzalcoatl, and then started to riff on that melody line with bizarre and vivid images, fecund free association, esoteric intellectual inside jokes, and wild time-bending juxtapositions. So my first question for Daniel is whether, as a fellow writer, I should hate you as much as I think I should. Does this incredible facility with language come as effortlessly to you as it seems?
If you should hate me, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's effortless. It took a lot of work to do the book, definitely.
So many of your sources, from the psychedelic to the academic, intimated that in 06 that world-shaking cataclysms were coming, but not in the usual sense of the word apocalypse. The word apocalypse comes from the Greek apo, which means to uncover, and calypse, like calypso, chaos. So another meaning might be that this is the time when we strip back the chaos, throwing back the covers on a bed, and reveal the simple and perhaps naked truth. But it seemed very prescient that there were so many signs of that were in your first book.
My second book, actually. Breaking Open the Head was the first book. I guess in the book I talked about 2008 possibly being a time of socioeconomic meltdown, and seems to be the case. I mean, it was sort of from Carl Johan Kalman's book, The Mind Calendar, The Transformation of Consciousness, where he looked at this kind of accelerating map of time speeding up. And also from my readings about the ecological and you know, crisis and the military-industrial situation, the financial situation. So, it's upon us now. I guess I don't personally feel very well prepared for it. I'm very concerned that we're really not, you know, in America, prepared for what could happen in the next couple of years, that we may see a lot of civil unrest here, civil strife, hunger, misery. I sort of still feel that we're in this moment, like the Wile E. Coyote moment, where like you've run across the cliff and your legs are still moving, but you haven't quite fully looked down yet, and then you fall. So I think just leave it. Yeah.
Just get rid of that. It's an interesting analogy, because I have that same sense that we really don't know what's hit us yet, that things right now are going on pretty much as normal. You walk into a supermarket and it's still stocked with food. And I have this feeling, you know, when we were talking about this backyard animal husbandry, that's not going to last, that we're going to look back and say, we remember, you know, remember when we used to go and just buy anything we wanted and it wasn't a problem. So it seems like your website, Reality Sandwich, has been moving towards ways of coping with that.
Yeah, I have a web magazine, realitysandwich.com, and actually we're just launching now a social network, evolver.net, which is finally live. And exactly. I mean, a lot of our work has been thinking about what this transformation process might be like, and then trying to, you know, become more active about not only proposing solutions, but then actually getting people to make them happen. I'm also working on a film project, 2012 Time for Change. There's a teaser for the film up at www.2012timeforchange.com. And in that film, you know, we talk about the prophecies, about kind of the global crisis, about personal transformation, and then we look at a whole range of solutions. And it has been really exciting because there are a lot of amazing solutions out there that if they became the focus you know, mass cultural attention and energy now, we could probably, you know, make significant progress. For instance, we just interviewed these people who have an aquaponics project on a barge in the river in New York, and they claim that using their types of techniques, 80% of the food supply for New York could be grown just on the rooftops in the city alone, if all the rooftops had rooftop gardens. Of course, none of the rooftops have rooftop gardens, you know. So, it almost feels, I mean, I've discussed this in the book, too, that, you know, are kind of, we're almost self-willing this total cataclysm and meltdown to bring about this transformation process.
I wanted to read a quote about technology from your book, 2012, in Jung. That Jung wrote, "Look at the devilish engines of destruction. They are invented by completely innocuous gentlemen, reasonable, respectable citizens who are everything we could wish. And when the whole thing blows up and an indescribably hell of destruction is let loose, nobody seems to be responsible. It simply happens, and yet it is all man-made." I couldn't resist including that because it seems so prescient of the economic crisis, the global food crisis, that we have this impression that it just happened by itself, when really it has been an extremely calculated design to monopolize wealth, and it's gone to its logical end, which is that it's a balloon that now has burst and is being discarded, having accomplished its purpose.
What do you mean by accomplished its purpose?
Transferred as much wealth as possible, and that we're carrying as much debt as, you know, as we can, as a beast of burden, and so, you know, we're kind of used up.
Well, I think they kind of overshot their purpose. I mean, because, you know, at the moment, they're having to just artificially simulate the banking system by pumping, you know, tens and hundreds of billions of dollars into it, and that's clearly not going to last, so... You know, it may be that everybody's money is about to become worthless, I think a lot of the people who are in the investment community are very upset and freaked out. You know, I mean, whether or not there's some deeper conspiratorial level to the whole thing, I think is an open question, but it's definitely possible.
I agree that I think the collapse of the currency being based on the petrodollar and the fact that other countries are now trading oil in other currencies is imminent, that it's just a matter of time before other countries stop producing goods for us and start moving to a market where their money is actually worth something.
So, yeah, so in the work that I've been doing since 2012 and the essays on Reality Sandwich, we've been looking at alternative currencies, complementary currencies, alternative exchange systems, local currencies, and I imagine there could be a huge surge of interest in those. I think we need ways for people to exchange value, goods and services outside of the dollar economy, and those can easily be systematized. There's already a bunch of them on the internet, but they just haven't scaled up very much. But yeah, I guess my deeper thing is, like, you can wallow in the anxiety over the negative social stuff that's happening, but I guess I would say that, you know, my way of articulating the more positive aspect is, we could think that maybe there's a that we're on the cusp of a species evolution from the biological and physical phase of evolution to more like a psychic and consciousness phase of evolution. Mm-hmm. So that, is I think, very promising and exciting.
I'm completely with you in thinking that there is an optimism. I think it's going to be painful, but I think it also is going to turn out better. And there are things that I've been working on for a long time, like alternative currencies, that... even 6 months ago, no one would have ever considered. And now we're looking at this thing called Food in the Hood, where we've got this neighborhood co-op going and looking at a community garden in my front and backyard, and, you know, the chickens and the rabbits, and doing a charity-based local currency, so that for every $50 that gets generated to a global charity, there's a fair trade 10 that then ends up continuing to circulate. And the way that the money is raised is by having students, high school students, learn sustainable skills so that they can build chicken coops, for instance, or install solar panels, and that instead of paying them, the person will make the donation, and then that will generate the currency.
Maybe I should be interviewing you.
Thank you so much. I'd love to read some of the titles from your latest book, from the... Perspectives on the Next Age. That these are essays on transformation edited with Ken Jordan, culled from the website. And some of them are The Testicular Age, Gnosis, the Not-So-Secret History of Jesus, Psyching Out the Cosmos, Homo Luminous, You with Wings, Finding Peace Between Our Sheets, Exorcising Christ from Christianity, Moby Click, and Is That a Real Reality or Did You Make It Up Yourself? One of the essays that really struck a deep chord with me was Blood and Breath by Barbara Alice Mann. I liked her because she was funny and she was pointed, and she also recognized that there is a cult following that fawns on Native American anything in terms of spirituality. And so she knows that, and she is, I like that self-awareness, and she talks a lot about how the Western tradition, everything revolves around one God, one true love, one soul, one right way, but that the base number of the Native tradition is two, being binary, not in the Western sense of dichotomy, but more in the sense that two are essential because it's through the two that we know the one. There's an ancient Sufi text that says that in the phrase you and me, there are three entities, the you, the me, and the and. It seemed to me that in your recent work and in the website that you've moved much more towards the and, that I was fascinated by 2012. But it was very self-absorbed in the most entertaining way. I mean, you really go deep into your own personal experience, and it's very intimate in that way. And now it seems that you're moving much more into community and kind of this social network. Is that true?
Maybe the 2012 was self-absorbed. In a way, I felt like, that the tale that I was telling would only be, kind of palatable to people if they felt that it was an authentic and trustworthy narrator. And I felt that could only be the case if I went out of my way to be, honest about, the good and bad aspects of my own personality. So I don't think the book would have had as much impact on many people if it didn't have so much personal, narrative and material in there. Mm-hmm. Having gone through that, process and writing that book, I then have been trying to figure out how to, take the insights I had and help them, go deeper into society. And I also, when the book came out, I began to get a huge amount of incredible emails and notes from people, and people just had so much amazing stuff to say, but there was really no perfect cultural filter for them to express themselves. So it was really out of that we created Reality Sandwich. Mm-hmm. And I'm very interested in this idea that Joseph Campbell talks about, that a process of initiation has these three stages, like separation, vision quest, initiation, and then return, where you bring the visions, the information you've gained, back to the larger community. And I feel like since the 60s, people have been going out and having these initiatory journeys, but they haven't really had the bridge back to the mainstream culture, their larger community. So I'm hoping that, if we can, grow our system to be a robust one that a lot of people are involved with, pay attention to, it'll help to, build that bridge for people to return with their initiatory knowledge.
I also find what you write about in terms of the Gnostics to be fascinating, because that's a particular point that I've done a lot of research on. And I've also done a lot of research on the traditional Bible, and my belief is that it's a pseudo-myth, that if a myth is defined as a series of stories that are told in order to reveal a larger truth, that a pseudo-myth is a series of stories that are told in order to obscure the truth, in order to twist the truth and turn it towards a different design, where all of the mystical writings go towards this and through into this oneness, that what destroys that is the idea that one person is superior to everyone else. And if you look at the Old Testament, it's an anti-Canaanite polemic. It is about the superiority of the Hebrew people to other tribes, particularly the tribes of Canaan. And I talk about that a lot on my last show. But that if you look at the myth of Jesus, that it is the superiority of one person over everyone, that all of us put together are not worth as much as this one person to God. And so I think there's more to be done with that, that the religion of your own culture is like medicine. I think there's a way in which it's an antidote that our bodies have called for, but that in the case of the Bible, I think that it was medicine that has been mixed with poison. And so it's like Gandhi's saying that the concept of untouchability is like arsenic mixed in milk, and that he wouldn't believe in the Hindu religion until you separated the two. But I think it's a good question as to whether it's possible to ever separate arsenic and milk. Does the Western tradition of religion, what's your relationship to it? Is it something that you just kind of disregard, or does it have any intrigue for you?
That was one of the longest questions I've ever been asked. I'm sort of lost in the ponderousness of it. My approach to Gnosticism, I really like this book by John Lash, Not in His Image. Have you looked at it?
No.
And he argues that the Gnostics were the inheritors of this pre-Christian mystery tradition wisdom, that they were sounding the alarm against Christianity, which they saw as a dangerous deviation potentially created by these non-human intelligences that the Gnostics referred to as archons, who had kind of tweaked the Christ mythos so that it worked against, it deviated humanity from its proper spiritual development. And they did that by sort of preying on our instinct towards wanting to perfect ourselves. So they made it into this like inhuman perfectionism, where you always had to turn the other cheek, which created this like victimizer bond, didn't really allow one to fight back against an oppressor, and that you had to love your neighbor as yourself, which I think is almost inhuman and impossible, really. By creating this kind of inhuman perfectionism in the concept of original sin, they created a very unhealthy spiritual environment. As opposed to Buddhism, where they have the concept of basic goodness, at the base level everybody is altruistic and good, which I actually think is much closer to reality.
In one of my shows, I talk about the ethics of anarchy, and that the word anarchy, of course, is comes from archons, from that Gnostic concept of archons. And so anarchy is self-rule. It is that we don't need those archons. We don't need the earthly rulers that have twisted everything, because we are directly, in tune with our own sense of what's right and what's wrong. And so it's a discipline. It isn't kind of the way that it's been interpreted as just being chaotic. But I think something I think the Gnostics... that they are really hints that there was something.
Well, I don't want to stay back to that old stuff, because I think what you just said is interesting to me. Like, we may see global revolutions the next few years, because people are understanding that they've been swindled and hoodwinked, and the average person who's been trying to spend their whole lives saving some money or getting a little retirement account, like all of that wealth has been sucked up into the maw of a tiny elite. Who are now desperately trying to cover their own, butts in a way. So I've been looking at books like Hannah Arendt's book On Revolution, where she looks at the past course of revolutions and where they tend to go wrong. And she notes that when there is a revolutionary uprising and a breakdown of centralized authority, actually people tend to do pretty well, and they tend to start, in the 1870s in Paris, there was the Paris Communes, or the original Soviets in Russia, where people start to self-organize, create local, community, governance in their factories or schools or whatever, and then even are able to nominate representatives to the next level. So I think there seems to be a natural political impulse that people have, which is actually squashed and suppressed by the top-down dominator culture that we've created. So it's an interesting prospect that in another, if there is a revolutionary scenario, there might be a way especially with the new social technologies of the internet, to aid in that self-organizing process. And Iran said what really made those other revolutions fail was that you would have people who were steeped in an ideology as revolutionary leaders step in, who believe that centralization was the goal. So they would be threatened by these anarchic, you know, rising up of all of these proto-political groups, and actually stamp them out, you know, if they could. So, you know, that points towards the possibility of an evolution in, you know, what could happen during a social transformation. If there's awareness of that, you know, you could actually just allow that basic tribal political instinct that people have to lead them to create new self-organizing emergent structures.
I think what you're talking about is really important, that it's not this either or, this dichotomy of either we have centralized rule, centralized economics, or we have nothing. You know, that there is this place in between of small communities and saying, we have the self-discipline. You know, we know what we want and we know how to get it. And if we are left to our own devices, we can figure this out. It's just getting that control back into a manageable and kind of a accountable level.
Well, on the other hand, I mean, we are going to have some kind of global organizing bodies or global confederacies because, you know, we can't allow, I mean, the oceans are now 90% fished out of large fish. There's going to have to be actually very stringent, you know, ecological controls placed on people's and corporations' behavior.
I think it goes both global and local and skips everything in between. That anything in between is this concept that, well, we can protect our own and we can get more that way by kind of banding together for our own self-interest, but that human rights are always universal. If they're not universal, they're not really human rights. They're just citizen privileges.
And so we just don't know what's going to happen, and we don't even know, you know, if there is going to be what level of social breakdown. But, you know, I'm sure there will be, you know, regional, you know, affiliations also. You know, maybe in the same way, once there was a shift from aristocratic regimes to, you know, bourgeois regimes, you know, the aristocracy usually survived as a vestigial form without as much political power. You know, maybe the nation-state form and the corporate form will survive, but they'll become more like vestigial if you have a bottom-up system where people are really participating.
There was one time I was at a conference with Adya Shanti and I forget, Llewellyn, who is a Sufi master, and I suggested that we conduct an experiment in oneness, that they talk all the time about, you know, this concept that we are all one. And so what I suggested is that if we really are all one, that we could probably do more for our own personal health and happiness by creating that for someone halfway around the world, and that without any losing anything for themselves, that they could, for instance, if someone paid twice as much as to get into their conference to a global charity, that they could allow them in for free. And so they could just try it out and see whether, when they did that, it made them feel any more happy and healthy and secure, rather than, you know, kind of, I find that economics gets left out. You know, that when we talk about this mystical concept of oneness and consciousness and the whole, you know, metanoia, that we talk about that, but what we actually do with our money or with our way of life is a completely disassociated thing.
Yeah, but I mean, so that's probably something that's about to change. You know, and I think we're going to see that, you know, the evolution of consciousness is going to, like, work on all these different levels. It's this, you know, we've had a lot of, like, transitional spiritual forms in the last decades.
So that does bring me to my final question, which ties together the Gnostics and the economics, which is that there's one apocryphal story, gospel, that I sent in my note, where the resurrected Christ appears to the apostles, who are all in hiding, and he says, you know, why are you guys hiding, and what do you want to know, and Philip is quick on his feet, and he jumps up and says, what's the underlying nature of reality, and what's the plan? So, what is the plan?
What is the plan? Well, I think the underlying nature of reality, I kind of like the Vedantic perspective of people like Ramesh and Nisargadatta, that basically there's a singular source consciousness that's projecting itself, you know, through all of us, that it can learn about itself and play and create and so on. So I think the plan is to, you know, turn our planet from a disaster to like a really great, you know, environmental art project.
I think that's a terrific idea, and I've been playing with the idea myself that we are actually not God's creation, but that we are God's creativity, that we are that force, we're that imagination, we're the means by which God makes things happen. And so I think re-envisioning and seeing what the world can be is actually it's more practical. It's more practical than mystical, I think. So thank you very much, Daniel. I appreciate you giving me the time. And this is Teresa Caraggio with Third Paradigm.
Sure. Well, I hope people will check out our new book, Toward 2012, Anthology of Works from Reality Sandwich. I hope they'll also check out realitysandwich.com and maybe join us on evolver.net, which is really a social network aimed at being like a scaffolding to help a social transformation process. And we're kind of looking at the Transition Town model from the UK. Do you know about Transition Town?
We have one here, as a matter of fact. That's the group that was talking about the local currencies.
So we're looking at that model, but we're kind of also adding on to it like the consciousness and shamanism and you know, those kind of elements. So thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you to Capitola Book Cafe.